William's hand closed on Ian's forearm, and his head, a dark oval in the last traces of light, jerked toward the woods. "Left," he whispered. "There are latrine trenches on the right. 2 pickets, 100 yards out."
He squeezed hard and let go.
"May you be held in God's light, friend William." Denny's whisper came breathless by Ian's ear, but Ian was already going and didn't know whether William had heard. He supposed it didn't matter. A few moments later, he heard the first shouts of "Fire!" behind him in the camp. Chapter 61. No better companion than the rifle. September 15th, 1777. By early September, we had reached the main army, encamped on the Hudson near the village of Saratoga. General Horatio Gates was in command, and received the ragtag and bobtail refugees and random militia with pleasure. For once, the army was tolerably well supplied, and we were equipped with clothes, decent food, and the remarkable luxury of a small tent in honour of Jamie's status as a colonel of militia, in spite of the fact that he had no men. Knowing Jamie as I did, I was reasonably sure that this would be a temporary state of affairs. For my part, I was delighted to have an actual cot to sleep on, a tiny table to eat from, and food to put on it on a fairly regular basis.
"I brought you a present, Sassenach."
Jamie plumped the bag down on the table with a pleasantly meaty-sounding thump and a waft of fresh blood. My mouth began to water. "What is it? Birds?" It wasn't ducks or geese. Those had a distinctive scent about them, a musk of body oils, feathers, and decaying water weeds. But partridges, say, or grouse? I swallowed heavily at the thought of pigeon pie.
"No, a brook."
He pulled a small package wrapped in tattered oilcloth from the bulging sack and proudly set it in my hands. "A book," I said blankly. He nodded encouragingly.
"Aye, words printed on paper, you'll recall the sort of thing. Again, it's been a long time."
I gave him an eye, and attempting to ignore the rumbling of my stomach, opened the package. It was a well-worn, pocket-sized copy of The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman, Volume 1. And despite my disgruntlement at being presented with literature instead of food, I was interested. It had been a long time since I'd had a good book in my hands, and this was a story I'd heard of but never read. "The owner must have been fond of it," I said, turning the little volume over gently. The spine was nearly worn through, and the edges of the leather cover were rubbed shiny. A rather nasty thought struck me. "Jamie, you didn't take this from a body, did you?" Stripping weapons, equipment, and usable clothing from fallen enemies was not considered looting. It was an unpleasant necessity. Still... He shook his head, though, still rummaging in the bag.
"Nay, I found it at the edge of a wee creek. Dropped in flight, I expect."
Well, that was better, though I was sure the man who had dropped it would regret the loss of this treasured companion. I opened the book at random and squinted at the small type.
"Sassenach."
"Hmm?" I glanced up, jerked out of the text, to see Jamie regarding me with a mixture of sympathy and amusement.
"You need spectacles, don't you?" he said. "I hadna realised."
"Nonsense," I said, though my heart gave a small jump. "I see perfectly well."
"Why?"
He moved beside me and took the book out of my hand. Opening it to the middle, he held it in front of me.
"Read that."
I leaned backward, and he advanced in front of me. "Stop that," I said. "How do you expect me to read anything that close?"
"Stand still then," he said,
and moved the book away from my face.
"Can you see the letters clear yet?"
"No," I said crossly. "Father." "Father? No, bloody father." And at last was obliged to admit that I couldn't bring the letters into focus at a distance of nearer than about 18 inches. "Well, it's very small type," I said, flustered and discomforted. I had, of course, been aware that my eyesight was not so keen as it once had been, but to be so rudely confronted with the evidence that I was, if not blind as a bat, definitely in competition with moles in the Farsight sweepstakes, was a trifle upsetting.
12-point Castlin, Jamie said, giving the text a professional glance. I will say the leading's terrible, he added critically, and the gutters are half what they should be. Even so...
He flipped the book shut and looked at me, one eyebrow raised.
You need spectacles, Anian, he repeated gently.
Hmm, I said. And on impulse, picked up the book, opened it, and handed it to him.
So, read it yourself, why don't you?
Looking surprised and a little wary, he took the book and looked into it, then extended his arm a little, and a little more. I watched, experiencing that same odd mix of amusement and sympathy as he finally held the book nearly at arm's length and read,
"So that the life of a writer, whatever he might fancy to the contrary, was not so much a state of composition as a state of warfare, and his probation in it precisely that of any other man militant upon earth, both depending alike, not half so much upon the degree of his wit as his resistance."
He closed it and looked at me, the edge of his mouth tucked back.
"I will," he said. "I can still shoot at least."
"And I can tell one herb from another by smell, I suppose," I said, and laughed. "Just as well. I don't suppose there's a spectacle maker this side of Philadelphia."
"No, I suppose not," he said ruefully. "When we get to Edinburgh, though, I ken just the man. I'll buy ye a tortoiseshell pair for every day, Sassenach, and a pair wi' gold rims for Sundays."
"Expect me to read the Bible with them, do you?" I inquired.
"Ah, no," he said. "That's just for show. After all..."
He picked up my hand, which smelled of dillweed and coriander, and, lifting it to his mouth, ran the point of his tongue delicately down the lifeline in my palm.
"The important things you do by touch, eh?"
We were interrupted by a cough from the door of the tent, and I turned to see a large bear-like man with long grey hair loose upon his shoulders. He had an amiable face with a scar through the upper lip and a mild but keen eye, which went at once to the bag on the table. I stiffened a little. There were strict prohibitions against the looting of farms, and while Jamie had taken these particular hens scratching in the wild, there was no way of proving that, and this gentleman, while dressed in casual homespun and hunting shirt, bore himself with the unmistakable authority of an officer.
"You be Colonel Fraser," he said, with a nod toward Jamie and extended a hand. "Daniel Morgan."
I recognized the name, though the only thing I knew about Daniel Morgan, a footnote in Brianna's eighth-grade history book, was that he was a famous rifleman. This wasn't particularly useful. Everyone knew that, and the camp had buzzed with interest when he had arrived at the end of August with a number of men. He now glanced with interest at me, and then at the bag of chickens, flecked with incriminating tufts of feather.
"By your leave, ma'am," he said,
and without waiting for my leave, picked up the sack and pulled out a dead chicken. The neck flopped limp, showing the large bloody hole through its head where an eye, well, two eyes, had once been. His scarred mouth pursed in a soundless whistle, and he looked sharply up at Jamie.
"You do that a purpose?" he asked. "I always shoot them through the eye," Jamie replied politely. "Dunno want to spoil the meat."
A slow grin spread over Colonel Morgan's face, and he nodded.
"Come with me, Mr. Fraser. Bring your rifle."
We ate that night at Daniel Morgan's fire, and the company, filled with chicken stew, raised cups of beer and hooted to toast the addition of a new member to their elite corps. I hadn't had a chance of private conversation with Jamie since Morgan's abduction of him that afternoon, and rather wondered what he made of his apotheosis. But he seemed comfortable with the rifleman, though he glanced now and then at Morgan with the look that meant he was still making up his mind. For my part, I was extremely pleased. By their nature, riflemen fought from a distance, and often a distance much greater than a musket's range. They were also valuable, and commanders were not likely to risk them in close combat. No soldier was safe, but some occupations had a much higher rate of mortality, and while I accepted the fact that Jamie was a born gambler, I liked him to have the best odds possible. Many of the riflemen were long hunters, others what they called over-mountain men, and thus had no wives with them here. Some did, and I made instant acquaintance with the women by the simple expedient of admiring one young woman's baby.
"Mrs. Fraser," one older lady said, coming to plump down on the log beside me, "are you the conjure woman?"
"I am," I said pleasantly.
"They call me the White Witch."
That reared them back a bit, but the forbidden has its own strong appeal. And after all, what could I do in the middle of a military camp, surrounded by their husbands and sons, all armed to the teeth?
Within minutes, I was dispensing advice on everything from menstrual cramps to colic. I caught a glimpse of Jamie, grinning at sight of my popularity, and gave him a discreet wave before turning back to my audience. The men, of course, continued drinking with outbreaks of raucous laughter. Then the fall of voices as one man took over a story, only to have the cycle repeat. At one point, though, the atmosphere changed so abruptly that I broke off an intense discussion of diaper rash and looked over toward the fire. Daniel Morgan was rising laboriously to his feet, and there was a distinct air of anticipation among the watching men. Was he about to make a speech welcoming Jamie?
"Oh, dear Lord," said Mrs. Graham under her breath beside me. "He's a-doing it again."
I hadn't time to ask her what he was a-doing before he a-did it. He shambled to the centre of the gathering, where he stood swaying like an old bear, his long grey hair wafting in the wind of the fire, and his eyes creased with amiability. They were focused on Jamie, though, I saw.
"Got something to show you, Mr. Fraser," he said, loudly enough that the women who'd still been talking stopped, every eye going to him.
He took hold of the hem of his long woolen hunting shirt and pulled it off over his head. He dropped it on the ground, spread his arms like a ballet dancer, and stumped slowly round. Everyone gasped, though from Mrs. Graham's remark, most of them must have seen it before. His back was ridged with scars from neck to waist. Old scars, to be sure, but there wasn't a square inch of unmarked skin on his back, massive as it was. Even I was shocked.
"The British did that,"
he said conversationally, turning back and dropping his arms.
"Give me 499 lashes. I counted."
The gathering erupted in laughter, and he grinned.
"Was supposed to give me 500, but he missed one. I didn't point it out to him."
More laughter. Obviously, this was a frequent performance, but one that his audience loved. There were cheers and more toasts when he finished and went to sit beside Jamie, still naked to the waist, his shirt wadded casually in his hand. Jamie's face gave nothing away, but I saw that his shoulders had relaxed. Evidently, he had made up his mind about Dan Morgan. Jamie lifted the lid of my small iron pot with an expression somewhere between caution and hope.
"Not food," I informed him,
rather unnecessarily, as he was wheezing in the manner of one who has inadvertently inhaled horseradish into the sinuses.
"I should hope not," he said, coughing and wiping his eyes. "Christ, Sassenach, that's worse than usual. Do you mean to poison someone?"
"Yes. Plasmodium vivax. Put the lid back on." I was simmering a decoction of cinchona bark and gallberries for the treatment of malarial cases.
"Have we got any food?"
he asked plaintively, dropping the lid back in place.
"In fact, we have."
I reached into the cloth-covered pail at my feet and triumphantly pulled out a meat pie, its crust golden and shimmering with lard. His face assumed the expression of an Israelite beholding the promised land, and he held out his hands, receiving the pie with the reverence due a precious object, though this impression was dispelled in the next instant as he took a large bite out of it.
"Where did you get it?"
he asked, after a few moments of blissful mastication.
"Are there more?"
"There are. A nice prostitute named Daisy brought them for me." He paused, examined the pie critically for signs of its provenance, then shrugged and took another bite.
"Do I want to know what it was you did for her, Sassenach?"
"Well, probably not while you're eating, no. Have you seen Ian?"
"No."
The response might have been abbreviated by the exigencies of eating pie, but I caught the slightest shiftiness in his manner and stopped, staring at him. "Do you know where Ian is?"
"More or less."
He kept his eyes fixed firmly on the meat pie, thus confirming my suspicions. "Do I want to know what he's doing?"
"No, you don't,"
he said definitely. "Oh, God." Ian Murray, having carefully dressed his hair with bear grease and a pair of turkey feathers, removed his shirt, leaving this rolled up with his tattered plaid under a log, and told Rollo to guard it, then walked across a small stretch of open ground towards the British camp.
"Hold!"
He turned a face of bored impassivity toward the sentry who had hailed him. The sentry, a boy of 15 or so, was holding a musket whose barrel shook noticeably. Ian hoped the numpty wouldn't shoot him by accident.
"Scout,"
he said succinctly, and walked past the sentry without a backward glance, though he felt a spider strolling to and fro between his shoulder blades.
"Scout," he thought,
and felt a small bubble of laughter rise up. Well, it was the truth, after all. He strolled to the camp in the same manner, ignoring the occasional stare, though most of those who noticed him merely glanced at him and then away. Burgoyne's headquarters was easy to spot, a large tent of green canvas that sprouted like a toadstool among the neat aisles of small white tents that housed the soldiers. It was some distance away, and he didn't mean to get any closer just now, but he could glimpse the comings and goings of staff officers, messengers, and the occasional scout, though none of these was Indian. The Indian camps were on the far side of the army encampment, scattered in the forest outside the neat military grid. He wasn't sure whether he might meet some of Tyenda Naga's people, who might in turn recognize him. This wouldn't be a difficulty, as he had said nothing regarding politics during his ill-fated visit to Joseph Brant's house. They would likely accept him on sight without any awkward questions. If he were to encounter some of the Huron and Oneida that Burgoyne employed to harass the Continentals, that might be a wee bit touchier. He had complete confidence in his ability to impress them with his identity as a Mohawk. But if they were either too suspicious or too impressed, he wouldn't learn much. He had learned a few things simply from his walk through the camp. Morale wasn't high. There was rubbish between some of the tents, and most of the washerwomen among the camp followers were sitting in the grass drinking gin, their kettles cold and empty. Still, the atmosphere in general seemed subdued but resolute. Some men were dicing and drinking, but more were melting lead and making musket balls, repairing or polishing their weapons. Food was short. He could sense hunger in the air, even without seeing the line of men waiting outside the baker's tent. None of them looked at him. They were focused on the loaves that emerged, these broken in half before being handed out.
Half rations, then. That was good.
None of this was important, though. And as for troop numbers and armament, these were well established by now. Uncle Jamie and Colonel Morgan and General Gates would like to know about the stores of powder and ammunition, but the artillery park and powder magazine would be well guarded, with no conceivable reason for an Indian scout to be nosing round there. Something tugged at the corner of his vision, and he glanced cautiously round, then hastily jerked his eyes forward, forcing himself to walk at the same pace. Jesus, it was the Englishman he'd saved from the swamp, the man who'd helped him get wee Denny free, and... He clamped down on that thought. He kent it well enough, no one could look like that and not be. But he felt it dangerous even to acknowledge the thought to himself, lest it somehow show on his face. He forced himself to breathe as usual, and walk without concern, because a Mohawk scout would have none. Damn! He'd meant to spend the remaining hours of daylight with some of the Indians, picking up what information he could, and then, after dark, come quietly back into camp, stealing up within earshot of Burgoyne's tent. If yon wee lieutenant was wuthering round, though, it might be too dangerous to try. The last thing he wanted was to meet the man face to face. Hey! The shout ran into his flesh like a sharp splinter. He recognised the voice, knew it was aimed at him, but didn't turn round. 6 paces, 5, 4, 3. He reached the end of an alley of tents and sheered off to the right, out of sight. Hey! The voice was closer, almost behind him, and he broke into a run, heading for the cover of the trees. Only one or two soldiers saw him. One started to his feet, but then stood, uncertain what to do, and he pushed past the man and dived into the trees. Well, that's torn it, he muttered, crouched behind a brush shelter. The tall lieutenant was questioning the man he'd shoved past. Both of them were looking toward the wood, the soldier shaking his head and shrugging helplessly. Christ, the wee loon was coming toward him! He turned and stepped silently through the trees, working his way deeper into the wood. He could hear the Englishman behind him crashing and rustling like a bear just out of its den in the spring. Murray! He was shouting. Murray, is that you? Wait! Wolf's brother, is that you? Ian said something very blasphemous under his breath in Gaelic and turned to see who had addressed him in Mohawk. It is you. Where's your demon wolf? Did something finally eat it? His old friend Glutton was beaming at him, adjusting his breech clout after having a piss. I hope something eats you, Ian said to his friend, keeping his voice low. I need to get away. There is an Englishman following me. Glutton's face changed at once, though it didn't lose either its smile or its eager expression. The wide grin widened further, and he jerked his head behind him, indicating the opening to a trail. Then his face went suddenly slack, and he staggered from one side to the other, lurching in the direction Ian had come. Ian barely made it out of sight before the Englishman called William came rushing into the clearing, only to run slap into Glutton, who clutched him by the lapels of his coat, gazed up soulfully into his eyes, and said, "Whiskey?" "I haven't any whiskey," William said, brusque but not impolite, and tried to detach Glutton. This proved a difficult proposition. Glutton was much more agile than his squat appearance suggested, and the instant a hand was removed from one spot, it clung, limpet-like, to another. To add to the performance, Glutton began to tell the lieutenant, in Mohawk, the story of the famous hunt that had given him his name, pausing periodically to shout, "Whiskey!" and fling his arms about the Englishman's body. Ian spared no time to admire the Englishman's own facility with language, which was considerable, but made off as fast as possible, circling to the west. He couldn't go back through the camp. He might take refuge in one of the Indian camps, but it was possible that William would look for him there, once he'd escaped from Glutton. "What the hell does he want with me?" he muttered, no longer bothering with silence, but cleaving the brush with a minimum of breakage. William, the lieutenant, had to know he was a Continental because of Denny Hunter and the deserter game. Yet he had not raised a general alarm upon seeing him, only called out in surprise, and then as one wanting conversation. Well, maybe that was a trick. Wee William might be young, but he was not stupid. Couldn't be, considering who his father... and the man was chasing him. He could hear voices fading behind him, and he thought that William had perhaps now recognised Glutton, in spite of the fact that he'd been half dead with fever when they met. If so, he would know Glutton was his, Ian's, friend, and instantly detect the ruse. But it didn't matter. He was well into the wood by now. William would never catch him. The smell of smoke and fresh meat caught his nose, and he turned, going downhill toward the bank of a small stream. There was a Mohawk camp there. He knew it at once. He paused, though. The scent of it, the knowledge of it, had drawn him like a moth. But he mustn't enter. Not now. If William had recognized Glutton, the first place he would look for Ian was the Mohawk's camp. And if she should be there...
"You, again," said an unpleasant Mohawk voice. "You don't learn, do you?"
Actually, he did. He'd learned enough to hit first. He turned on his heel and swung from somewhere behind his knees, continuing up with all the power in his body.
"Aim to hit through the bugger's face," Uncle Jamie had instructed him when he began to go about in Edinburgh alone.
It was, as usual, good advice. His knuckles burst with a crunch that shot blue lightning straight up his arm and into his neck and jaw. But Sun Elk flew backward 2 paces and crashed into a tree. Ian stood panting and gently touching his knuckles, recalling too late that Uncle Jamie's advice had begun with, "Hit them in the soft parts if you can." It didn't matter. It was worth it. Sun Elk was moaning softly, his eyelids fluttering. Ian was debating the merits of saying something of a dismissive nature and walking grandly away, versus kicking him in the balls again before he could get up, when William the Englishman walked out from the trees. He looked from Ian, still breathing as though he'd run a mile, to Sun Elk, who had rolled onto his hands and knees but didn't seem to want to get up. Blood was dripping from his face onto the dead leaves. Splat, splat.
"I have no wish to intrude upon a private affair," William said politely, "but I would appreciate a word with you, Mr. Murray."
He turned, not waiting to see if Ian would come, and walked back into the trees. Ian nodded, having no notion what to say, and followed the Englishman, cherishing in his heart the last faint splat of Sun Elk's blood. The Englishman was leaning against a tree, watching the Mohawk camp by the stream below. A woman was stripping meat from a fresh deer's carcass, hanging it to dry on a frame. She wasn't works with her hands. William switched his dark blue gaze to Ian, giving him an odd feeling. Ian already felt odd, though, so it didn't really matter.
"I am not going to ask what you were doing in the camp."
"Why?"
"No. I wish to thank you for the horse and money, and to ask you whether you have seen Miss Hunter, since you so kindly left me in the keeping of her and her brother."
"I have. Aye."
The knuckles on his right hand were already puffed to twice their size and starting to throb. He'd go and see Rachel. She'd bandaged them for him. The thought was so intoxicating that he didn't at first realize that William was waiting, not all that patiently, for him to expound on his statement.
"Ah, aye, the hunters with the army. The, other army," he said a little awkwardly. "Her brother's an army surgeon."
William's face didn't change, but seemed somehow to solidify. Ian watched it in fascination. He'd seen Uncle Jamie's face do the exact same thing many times, and knew what it meant.
"Here," William said. "Aye, here."
He inclined his head toward the American camp.
"There, I mean."
"I see," William said calmly.
"When you see her again, will you give her my kindest regards then? And her brother, too, of course."
"Why?"
Ian said, thinking.
"Like that, is it? Well, you're no going to see her yourself, and she'd have nothing to do with a soldier anyway, so think again."
"Certainly," he added, belatedly aware that his only value to William at this point lay in his supposed role as messenger to Rachel Hunter, and wondering just how much that was worth.
Thank you.
William's voice had lost that look of iron. He was examining Ian carefully, and at last nodded.
A life for a life, Mr. Murray, he said quietly. We're quits. Don't let me see you next time. I may not have a choice.
He turned and left, the red of his uniform visible for some time through the trees. Chapter 62. One Just Man. September the 19th, 1777. The sun rose invisible to the sound of drums. Drums on both sides. We could hear the British reveille, and by the same token they must hear ours. The riflemen had had a brief skirmish with British troops 2 days before, and owing to the work of Ian and the other scouts, General Gates knew very well the size and disposition of Burgoyne's army. Kosciuszko had chosen Bemis Heights for a defensive position. It was a high river bluff, with numerous small ravines down to the river, and his crews had laboured like madmen for the last week with shovels and axes. The Americans were ready, more or less. The women were not, of course, admitted to the councils of the generals. Jamie was, though, and thus I heard all about the argument between General Gates, who was in command, and General Arnold, who thought he should be. General Gates, who wanted to sit tight on Bemis Heights and wait for the British attack, versus General Arnold, who argued vehemently that the Americans must make the first move, forcing the British regulars to fight through the thickly wooded ravines, ruining their formations, and making them vulnerable to the riflemen's sniper fire, falling back, if necessary, to the breastworks and entrenchments on the heights.
Arnold's won,
Ian reported, popping briefly up out of the fog to snag a piece of toasted bread.
Uncle Jamie's away with a rifleman already. He says he'll see you this evening, and in the meantime...
He bent and gently kissed my cheek, then grinned impudently and vanished. My own stomach was knotted, though with the pervasive excitement as much as with fear. The Americans were a ragged, motley lot, but they had had time to prepare. They knew what was coming, and they knew what was at stake. This battle would decide the campaign in the north. Either Burgoyne would overcome and march on, trapping George Washington's army near Philadelphia between his forces and General Howe's, or his army of invasion would be brought to a halt and knocked out of the war, in which case Gates' army could move south to reinforce Washington. The men all knew it, and the fog seemed electric with their anticipation. By the sun, it was near 10 o'clock when the fog lifted. The shots had begun some time earlier, brief, distant pings of rifle fire. Daniel Morgan's men were taking out the pickets, I thought, and knew from what Jamie had said the night before that they were meant to aim for the officers, to kill those soldiers wearing silver gorgets. I hadn't slept the night before, envisioning Lieutenant Ransom and the silver gorget at his throat. In fog, in the dust of battle, at a distance? I swallowed, but my throat stayed stubbornly closed. I couldn't even drink water. Jamie had slept, with the stubborn concentration of a soldier, but had waked in the deep hours of the night, his shirt soaked with sweat in spite of the chill, trembling. I didn't ask what he'd been dreaming about. I knew. I had got him a dry shirt and made him lie down again with his head in my lap, then stroked his head until he closed his eyes. But I thought he hadn't slept again. It wasn't chilly now. The fog had burned away, and we heard sustained rattles of gunfire, patchy, but repeated volleys. Faint, distant shouting, but impossible to make out who was shouting what at whom. Then the sudden crash of a British field piece, a resounding boom that struck the camp silent. A lull, and then full-scale battle broke out, shooting and screaming, and the intermittent thud of cannon. Women huddled together or set about grimly packing up their belongings in case we should have to flee. About midday, a relative silence fell. Was it over? We waited. After a little, children began whining to be fed, and a sort of tense normality descended, but nothing happened. We could hear moaning and calls for help from men wounded, but no wounded were brought in. I was ready. I had a small mule-drawn wagon equipped with bandages and medical equipment, and a small tent as well, which I could set up in case I needed to perform surgery in the rain. The mule was staked nearby, grazing placidly, and ignoring both the tension and the occasional burst of musketry. In the middle of the afternoon, hostilities broke out again, and this time the camp followers and cook wagons actually began to retreat. There was artillery on both sides. Enough of it that the continuous cannonading rolled like thunder, and I saw a huge cloud of black powder smoke rise up from the bluff. It wasn't quite mushroom-shaped, but it made me think nonetheless of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I sharpened my knife and scalpels for the dozenth time. It was near evening. The sun sank invisibly, staining the fog with a dull and sullen orange. The evening wind off the river was rising, lifting the fog from the ground and sending it scudding in billows and swirls. Clouds of black powder smoke lay heavy in the hollows, lifting more slowly than the lighter shreds of mist, and lending a suitable stink of brimstone to a scene that was, if not hellish, at least bloody eerie. Here and there a space would suddenly be cleared, like a curtain pulled back to show the aftermath of battle. Small dark figures moved in the distance, darting and stooping, stopping suddenly, heads uplifted like baboons keeping watch for a leopard. Camp followers, the wives and whores of the soldiers, come like crows to scavenge the dead. Children, too. Under a bush, a boy of 9 or 10 straddled the body of a red-coated soldier, smashing at the face with a heavy rock. I stopped, paralysed at the sight, and saw the boy reach into the gaping, bloodied mouth and wrench out a tooth. He slipped the bloody prize into a bag that hung by his side, groped farther, tugging, and finding no more teeth loose, picked up his rock in a businesslike way and went back to work. I felt bile rise in my throat and hurried on, swallowing. I was no stranger to war, to death and wounds, but I had never been so near a battle before. I had never before come on a battlefield where the dead and wounded still lay before the ministrations of medics and burial details. There were calls for help, and occasional moans or screams, ringing disembodied out of the mist, reminding me uncomfortably of Highland stories of the Uriska, the doomed spirits of the glen. Like the heroes of such stories, I didn't stop to heed their call, but pressed on, stumbling over small rises, slipping on damp grass. I had seen photographs of the great battlefields, from the American Civil War to the beaches of Normandy. This was nothing like that. No churned earth, no heaps of tangled limbs. It was still, save for the noises of the scattered wounded, and the voices of those calling, like me, for a missing friend or husband. Shattered trees lay toppled by artillery. In this light, I might have thought the bodies turned into logs themselves, dark shapes lying long in the grass, save for the fact that some of them still moved. Here and there a form stirred feebly, victim of war sorcery, struggling against the enchantment of death. I paused and shouted into the mist, calling his name. I heard answering calls, but none in his voice. Ahead of me lay a young man, arms outflung, a look of blank astonishment on his face, blood pooled round his upper body like a great halo. His lower half lay 6 feet away. I walked between the pieces, keeping my skirts close, nostrils pinched tight against the thick iron smell of blood. The light was fading now, but I saw Jamie as soon as I came over the edge of the next rise. He was lying on his face in the hollow, one arm flung out, the other curled beneath him. The shoulders of his dark blue coat were nearly black with damp, and his legs thrown wide, booted heels askew. The breath caught in my throat, and I ran down the slope toward him, heedless of grass, clumps, mud, and brambles. As I got closer, I saw a scuttling figure dart out from behind a nearby bush and dash toward him. It fell to its knees beside him, and without hesitation grasped his hair and yanked his head to one side. Something glinted in the figure's hand, bright, even in the dull light. "Stop!" I shouted. "Drop it, you bastard!" Startled, the figure looked up as I flung myself over the last yards of space. Narrow, red-rimmed eyes glared up at me out of a round face streaked with soot and grime. "Get off," she snarled. "I found him first." It was a knife in her hand. She made little jabbing motions at me in an effort to drive me away. I was too furious and too afraid for Jamie to be scared for myself. "Let go of him. Touch him and I'll kill you," I said. My fists were clenched, and I must have looked as though I meant it, for the woman flinched back, loosing her hold on Jamie's hair. "He's mine," she said, thrusting her chin pugnaciously at me. "Go find yourself another." Another form slipped out of the mist and materialized by her side. It was the boy I had seen earlier, filthy and scruffy as the woman herself. He had no knife, but clutched a crude metal strip cut from a canteen. The edge of it was dark, with rust or blood. He glared at me.
"He's ours," Mum said. "Get on with you, scat!"
Not waiting to see whether I would or not, he flung a leg over Jamie's back, sat on him, and began to grope in the side pockets of his coat.
"He's still alive, Mum," he advised. "I can feel his heart beating. Best slit his throat quick. I don't think he's bad hurt."
I grabbed the boy by the collar and jerked him off Jamie's body, making him drop his weapon. He squealed and flailed at me with arms and elbows, but I kneed him in the rump hard enough to jar his backbone, then got my elbow locked about his neck in a stranglehold, his skinny wrist vised in my other hand.
"Leave him go."
The woman's eyes narrowed like a weasel's, and her eye teeth shone in a snarl. I didn't dare take my eyes away from the woman's long enough to look at Jamie. I could see him, though, at the edge of my vision, head turned to the side, his neck gleaming white, exposed and vulnerable. "Stand up and step back," I said, "or I'll choke him to death, I swear I will." She crouched over Jamie's body, knife in hand, as she measured me, trying to make up her mind whether I meant it. I did. The boy struggled and twisted in my grasp, his feet hammering against my shins. He was small for his age and thin as a stick, but strong nonetheless. It was like wrestling an eel. I tightened my hold on his neck. He gurgled and quit struggling. His hair was thick with rancid grease and dirt, the smell of it rank in my nostrils. Slowly the woman stood up. She was much smaller than I, and scrawny with it. Bony wrists stuck out of ragged sleeves. I couldn't guess her age. Under the filth and the puffiness of malnutrition, she might have been anything from 20 to 50.
"My man lies yonder, dead on the ground," she said, jerking her head at the fog behind her. "He hadn't nothing but his musket, and the sergeant will take that back."
Her eyes slid toward the distant wood where the British troops had retreated.
"I'll find a man soon, but I've children to feed in the meantime, 2 besides the boy."
She licked her lips, and a coaxing note entered her voice.
"You're alone. You can manage better than we can. Let me have this one. There's more over there."
She pointed with her chin toward the slope behind me, where the rebel dead and wounded lay. My grasp must have loosened slightly as I listened, for the boy, who had hung quiescent in my grasp, made a sudden lunge and burst free, diving over Jamie's body to roll at his mother's feet. He got up beside her, watching me with rat's eyes, beady bright and watchful. He bent and groped about in the grass, coming up with a makeshift dagger.
"Hold her off, Mum," he said, his voice raspy from the choking. "I'll take him."
From the corner of my eye, I had caught the gleam of metal half buried in the grass.
"Wait," I said, and took a step back.
Don't kill him. Don't. A step to the side, another back. I'll go. I'll let you have him, but... I lunged to the side and got my hand on the cold metal hilt. I had picked up Jamie's sword before. It was a cavalry sword, larger and heavier than usual, but I didn't notice now. I snatched it up and swung it in a two-handed arc that ripped the air and left the metal ringing in my hands. Mother and son jumped back, identical looks of ludicrous surprise on their round, grimy faces. "Get away," I said. Her mouth opened, but she didn't say anything. "I'm sorry for your man," I said, "but my man lies here." "Get away," I said. I raised the sword and the woman stepped back hastily, dragging the boy by the arm. She turned and went, muttering curses at me over her shoulder, but I paid no attention to what she said. The boy's eyes stayed fixed on me as he went, dark coals in the dim light. He would know me again, and I him. They vanished in the mist, and I lowered the sword, which suddenly weighed too much to hold. I dropped it on the grass and fell to my knees beside Jamie. My own heart was pounding in my ears, and my hands were shaking with reaction as I groped for the pulse in his neck. I turned his head and could see it throbbing steadily just below his jaw. "Thank God," I whispered to myself. "Oh, thank God." I ran my hands over him quickly, searching for injury before I moved him. I didn't think the scavengers would come back. I could hear the voices of a group of men, distant on the ridge behind me, a rebel detail coming to fetch the wounded. There was a large knot on his brow, already turning purple. Nothing else that I could see. The boy had been right, I thought with gratitude. He wasn't badly hurt. Then I rolled him onto his back and saw his hand. Highlanders were accustomed to fight with sword in one hand, targe in the other, the small leather shield used to deflect an opponent's blow. He hadn't had a targe. The blade had struck him between the third and fourth fingers of his right hand and sliced through the hand itself, a deep, ugly wound that split his palm and the body of his hand halfway to the wrist. Despite the horrid look of the wound, there wasn't much blood. The hand had been curled under him, his weight acting as a pressure bandage. The front of his shirt was smeared with red, deeply stained over his heart. I ripped open his shirt and felt inside to be sure that the blood was from his hand. But it was. His chest was cool and damp from the grass, but unscathed, his nipples shrunken and stiff with chill.
"That tickles," he said in a drowsy voice.
He pawed awkwardly at his chest with his left hand, trying to brush my hand away. "Sorry," I said, repressing the urge to laugh with the joy of seeing him alive and conscious. I got an arm behind his shoulders and helped him to sit up. He looked drunk, with one eye swollen half shut and grass in his hair. He acted drunk too, swaying alarmingly from side to side.
"How do you feel?" I asked.
"Sick," he said succinctly.
He leaned to the side and threw up. I eased him back on the grass and wiped his mouth, then set about bandaging his hand.
"Someone will be here soon," I assured him. "We'll get you back to the wagon, and I can take care of this."
"Mm-hmm."
He grunted slightly as I pulled the bandage tight.
"What happened?"
"What happened?"
I stopped what I was doing and stared at him.
"You're asking me?"
"What happened in the battle, I mean," he said patiently, regarding me with his one good eye. "I know what happened to me, roughly," he added, wincing as he touched his forehead.
"Yes, roughly," I said rudely. "You got yourself chopped like a butchered hog and your head half caved in. Being a sodding bloody hero again, that's what happened to you."
"I wasn't,"
he began. But I interrupted, my relief over seeing him alive being rapidly succeeded by rage.
"You didn't have to go to Ticonderoga. You shouldn't have gone. Stick to the writing and the printing," you said. You weren't going to fight unless you had to, you said. Well, you didn't have to, but you did it anyway, you vainglorious, pig-headed, grandstanding Scot.
Grandstanding? He inquired.
You know just what I mean, because it's just what you did. You might have been killed.
Aye, he agreed ruefully. I thought I was when the dragoon came down on me. I screeched and scared his horse, though, he added more cheerfully. It reared up and got me in the face with its knee.
Don't change the subject, I snapped.
Is the subject not that I'm not killed?
He asked, trying to raise one brow and failing with another wince. No! The subject is your stupidity, your bloody selfish stubbornness.
Oh, that.
Yes, that, you oaf. How dare you do that to me? You think I haven't got anything better to do with my life than trot round after you, sticking pieces back on?
I was frankly shrieking at him by this time. To my increased fury, he grinned at me, his expression made the more rakish by the half-closed eye. You'd have made a good fishwife, Sassenach, he observed. You've the tongue for it.
You shut up, you fucking bloody...
They'll hear you, he said mildly, with a wave toward the party of Continental soldiers making their way down the slope toward us.
I don't care who hears me. If you weren't already hurt, I'd...
Be careful, Sassenach, he said, still grinning. You didn't want to knock off any more pieces. You'll only have to stick 'em back on, aye?
Don't bloody tempt me, I said through my teeth, with a glance at the sword I had dropped. He saw it and reached for it, but couldn't quite manage. With an explosive snort, I leaned across his body and grabbed the hilt, putting it in his hand. I heard a shout from the men coming down the hill and turned to wave at them.
Anyone hearing you just now would likely think you didn't care for me overmuch, Sassenach, he said behind me.
I turned to look down at him. The impudent grin was gone, but he was still smiling.
You've the tongue of a venomous shrew, he said, but you're a bonny wee swordsman, Sassenach.
My mouth opened, but the words that had been so abundant a moment before had all evaporated like the rising mist. He laid his good hand on my arm.
For now, Aneon Dune, thank you for my life.
I closed my mouth. The men had nearly reached us, rustling through the grass, their exclamations and chatter drowning out the ever fainter moans of the wounded.
You're welcome, I said. Hamburger, I said under my breath, but not far enough under.
He raised an eyebrow at me. Chopped meat, I elaborated, and the eyebrow fell.
Oh, aye, it is. Stopped a sword stroke with my hand. Too bad I didn't have a targe. I could have turned the stroke easy.
Right, I swallowed. It wasn't the worst injury I'd seen by a long shot, but it still made me slightly sick. The tip of his fourth finger had been sheared off cleanly at an angle just below the nail. The stroke had sliced a strip of flesh from the inside of the finger and ripped down between the third and fourth fingers.
You must have caught it near the hilt, I said, trying for calm,
or it would have taken off the outside half of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
The hand didn't move as I prodded and poked, but there was sweat on his upper lip, and he couldn't keep back a brief grunt of pain. Sorry, I murmured automatically.
That's all right, he said, just as automatically.
He closed his eyes, then opened them.
Take it off, he said suddenly.
What? I drew back and looked at him, startled. He nodded at his hand.
A finger. Take it off, Sassenach.
I can't do that. Even as I spoke, though, I knew that he was right. Apart from the injuries to the finger itself, the tendon was badly damaged. The chances of his ever being able to move the finger, let alone move it without pain, were infinitesimal.
has done me little good in the last 20 years, he said, looking at the mangled stump dispassionately, and likely to do no better now. I've broken the damn thing 6 times from its sticking out like it does. If you take it off, it will not trouble me any more, at least.
I wanted to argue, but there was no time. Wounded men were beginning to drift up the slope toward the wagon. The men were militia, not regular army. If there was a regiment near, there might be a surgeon with them, but I was closer.
Once a frigging hero, always a frigging hero, I muttered under my breath.
I thrust a wad of lint into Jamie's bloody palm and wrapped a linen bandage swiftly round the hand. Yes, I'll have to take it off, but later. Hold still.
Ouch, he said mildly. I did say I wasn't a hero.
If you aren't, it isn't for lack of trying, I said, yanking the linen knot tight with my teeth. There, that will have to do for now. I'll see to it when I have time. I grabbed the wrapped hand and plunged it into the small basin of alcohol and water. He went white as the alcohol seeped through the cloth and struck raw flesh. He inhaled sharply through his teeth, but didn't say anything more. I pointed peremptorily at the blanket I had spread on the ground, and he lay back obediently, curling up under the shelter of the wagon, bandaged fist cradled against his breast. I rose from my knees, but hesitated for a moment. Then I knelt again and hastily kissed the back of his neck, brushing aside the queue of his hair, matted with half-dried mud and dead leaves. I could just see the curve of his cheek. It tightened briefly as he smiled, and then relaxed. Word had spread that the hospital wagon was there. There was already a straggling group of walking wounded awaiting attention, and I could see men carrying or half-carrying their injured companions toward the light of my lantern. It was going to be a busy evening. Colonel Everett had promised me 2 assistants, but God knew where the colonel was at the moment. I took a moment to survey the gathering crowd and picked out a young man who had just deposited a wounded friend beneath a tree. You, I said, tugging on his sleeve. Are you afraid of blood? He looked momentarily startled, then grinned at me through a mask of mud and powder smoke. He was about my height, broad-shouldered and stocky, with a face that might have been called cherubic had it been less filthy.
Only if it's mine, ma'am, and so far it ain't, Lord be praised.
Then come with me, I said, smiling back. You're now a triage aide.
Say what? Hey, Harry, he yelled to his friend. I've been promoted. Tell your mama next time you write. Lester done amounted to something after all.
He swaggered after me, still grinning. The grin rapidly faded into a look of frowning absorption as I led him quickly among the wounded, pointing out degrees of severity. Men pouring blood are the first priority, I told him. I thrust an armful of linen bandages and a sack of lint into his hands. Give them these. Tell their friends to press the lint hard on the wounds, or put a tourniquet around the limb above the wound. You know what a tourniquet is?
Oh, yes, ma'am, he assured me. Put one on, too, when a panther clawed up my cousin Jess down to Caroline County.
Good. Don't spend time doing it yourself here, unless you have to, though. Let their friends do it. Now, broken bones can wait a bit. Put them over there under that big beech tree. Head injuries and internal injuries that aren't bleeding back there by the chestnut tree, if they can be moved. If not, I'll go to them. I pointed behind me, then turned in a half circle, surveying the ground. If you see a couple of whole men, send them up to put up the hospital tent. It's to go in that flattish spot there. And then a couple more to dig a latrine trench. Over there, I think.
Yes, sir. Ma'am, I mean.
Lester bobbed his head and took a firm grip on his sack of lint.
I'll be right after it, ma'am. Though won't worry none about the latrines for a while, he added. Most of these boys already done had the shit scared out of them.
He grinned and bobbed once more, then set out on his rounds. He was right. The faint stink of feces hung in the air, as it always did on battlefields, a low note amid the pungencies of blood and smoke. With Lester sorting the wounded, I settled down to the work of repair with my medicine box, suture bag, and bowl of alcohol set on the wagon's tailboard, and a keg of alcohol for the patients to sit on, provided they could sit. The worst of the casualties were bayonet wounds. Luckily, there had been no grape shot, and the men hit by cannonballs were long past the point where I could help them. As I worked, I listened with half an ear to the conversation of the men awaiting attention.
"Wasn't that the damnedest thing you ever saw? How many of the buggers were there?" one man was asking his neighbour. "Damned if I know," his friend replied, shaking his head. "For a space there, everything I saw was red and nothing but. Then a cannon went off right close, and I didn't see nothing but smoke for a good long time."
He rubbed at his face. Tears from watering eyes had made long streaks in the black soot that covered him from chest to forehead. I glanced back at the wagon, but couldn't see under it. I hoped shock and fatigue had enabled Jamie to sleep in spite of his hand, but I doubted it. Despite the fact that nearly everyone near me was wounded in some fashion, their spirits were high, and the general mood was one of exuberant relief and exultation. Farther down the hill, in the mists near the river, I could hear whoops and shouts of victory and the undisciplined racket of fifes and drums rattling and screeching in random exhilaration. Among the noise, a nearer voice called out, a uniformed officer on a bay horse.
"Anybody seen that big red-headed bastard who broke the charge?"
There was a murmur and a general looking around, but no one answered. The horseman dismounted, and wrapping his reins over a branch, made his way through the throng of wounded toward me.
"Whoever he is, I tell you, he's got balls the size of 10-pound shot," remarked the man whose cheek I was stitching. "And a head of the same consistency," I murmured. "Eh?"
He glanced sideways at me in bewilderment.
"Nothing," I said. "Hold still just a moment longer. I'm nearly done."
It was a hellish night. Some of the wounded still lay in the ravines and hollows, as did all the dead. The wolves that came silently out of the wood did not distinguish between them, judging from the distant screams. It was nearly dawn before I came back to the tent where Jamie lay. I lifted the flap quietly so as not to disturb him, but he was already awake, lying curled on his side facing the flap, head resting on a folded blanket. He smiled faintly when he saw me.
"Hard night, Sassenach?"
he asked, his voice slightly hoarse from cold air and disuse. Mist seeped under the edge of the flap, tinted yellow by the lantern light. "I've had worse." I smoothed the hair off his face, looking him over carefully. He was pale, but not clammy. His face was drawn with pain, but his skin was cool to the touch, no trace of fever. "You haven't slept, have you? How do you feel?"
"A bit scared," he said, "and a bit sick. But better now you're here."
He gave me a one-sided grimace that was almost a smile. I put a hand under his jaw, fingers pressed against the pulse in his neck. His heart bumped steadily under my fingertips, and I shivered briefly, remembering the woman in the field.
"You're chilled, Sassenach," he said, feeling it, "and tired too. Go and sleep, I'll do a bit longer."
I was tired. The adrenaline of the battle and the night's work was fading fast. Fatigue was creeping down my spine and loosening my joints. But I had a good idea of what the hours of waiting had cost him already. "It won't take long," I reassured him, "and it will be better to have it over. Then you can sleep easy." He nodded, though he didn't look noticeably reassured. I unfolded the small work table I had carried in from the operating tent and set it up in easy reach. Then I took out the precious bottle of laudanum and poured an inch of the dark, odorous liquid into a cup.
"Sip it slowly," I said, putting it into his left hand.
I began to lay out the instruments I would need, making sure that everything lay orderly and to hand.
I had thought of asking Lester to come and assist me, but he had been asleep on his feet, swaying drunkenly under the dim lanterns in the operating tent, and I had sent him off to find a blanket and a spot by the fire. A small scalpel, freshly sharpened. The jar of alcohol, with the wet ligatures coiled inside like a nest of tiny vipers, each toothed with a small curved needle. Another with the waxed dry ligatures for arterial compression. A bouquet of probes, their ends soaking in alcohol. Forceps, long-handled retractors. The hooked tenaculum for catching the ends of severed arteries. The surgical scissors with their short curved blades and the handle shaped to fit my grasp, made to my order by the silversmith Stephen Moray. Or almost to my order. I had insisted that the scissors be as plain as possible to make them easy to clean and disinfect. Stephen had obliged with a chaste and elegant design, but hadn't been able to resist one small flourish. One handle boasted a hook-like extension against which I could brace my little finger in order to exert more force, and this extrusion formed a smooth, lithe curve, flowering at the tip into a slender rosebud against a spray of leaves. The contrast between the heavy, vicious blades at one end and this delicate conceit at the other always made me smile when I lifted the scissors from their case. Strips of cotton gauze and heavy linen, pads of lint, adhesive plasters stained red with the dragon's blood juice that made them sticky, an open bowl of alcohol for disinfection as I worked, and the jars of cinchona bark, mashed garlic paste, and yarrow for dressing. "There we are," I said with satisfaction, checking the array one last time. Everything must be ready since I was working by myself. If I forgot something, no one would be at hand to fetch it for me.
"It seems a great deal of preparation for one measly finger," Jamie observed behind me.
I swung around to find him leaning on one elbow, watching, the cup of laudanum undrunk in his hand.
"Could you not just whack it off with a wee knife and seal the wound with hot iron like the regimental surgeons do?"
"I could, yes," I said dryly. "But fortunately, I don't have to. We have enough time to do the job properly. That's why I made you wait."
"Mm-hmm."
He surveyed the row of gleaming instruments without enthusiasm, and it was clear that he would much rather have had the business over and done with as quickly as possible. I realized that to him, this looked like slow and ritualized torture rather than sophisticated surgery.
"I mean to leave you with a working hand," I told him firmly. "No infection, no suppurating stump, no clumsy mutilation, and, God willing, no pain once it heals."
His eyebrows went up at that. He had never mentioned it, but I was well aware that his right hand and its troublesome fourth finger had caused him intermittent pain for years, ever since it had been crushed at Wentworth Prison when he was held prisoner there in the days before the Stuart Rising. "A bargain's a bargain," I said, with a nod at the cup in his hand. "Drink it." He lifted the cup and poked a long nose reluctantly over the rim, nostrils twitching at the sickly sweet scent. He let the dark liquid touch the end of his tongue and made a face.
"It will make me sick."
"It will make you sleep."
"It gives me terrible dreams."
"As long as you don't chase rabbits in your sleep, it won't matter," I assured him. He laughed, despite himself, but had one final try.
"It tastes like the stuff you scrape out of horses' hooves."
"And when was the last time you licked a horse's hoof?" I demanded, hands on my hips. I gave him a medium-intensity glare, suitable for the intimidation of petty bureaucrats and low-level army officials. He sighed.
"You mean it, eh?"
"I do."
"All right, then."
With a reproachful look of long-suffering resignation, he threw back his head and tossed the contents of the cup down in one gulp. A convulsive shudder racked him and he made small choking noises. "I did say to sip it," I observed mildly. "Vomit,
and I'll make you lick it up off the floor.
Given the scuffled dirt and trampled grass underfoot, this was plainly an idle threat. But he pressed his lips and eyes tight shut and lay back on the pillow, breathing heavily and swallowing convulsively every few seconds. I brought up a low stool and sat down by the camp bed to wait.
"How do you feel?" I asked a few minutes later.
"Dizzy," he replied.
He cracked one eye open and viewed me through the narrow blue slit, then groaned and closed it.
"As if I'm falling off a cliff. It's a very unpleasant sensation, Sassenach."
"Try to think of something else for a minute," I suggested. "Something pleasant, to take your mind off it."
His brow furrowed for a moment, then relaxed.
"Stand up a moment, will you?" he said.
I obligingly stood, wondering what he wanted. He opened his eyes, reached out with his good hand, and took a firm grip of my buttock.
"There," he said. "That's the best thing I can think of. Having a good hold on your arse always makes me feel steady."
I laughed and moved a few inches closer to him, so his forehead pressed against my thighs.
"Well, it's a portable remedy, at least."
He closed his eyes then and held on tight, breathing slowly and deeply. The harsh lines of pain and exhaustion in his face began to soften as the drug took effect.
"Jamie," I said softly after a minute, "I'm sorry about it."
He opened his eyes, looked upward, and smiled, giving me a slight squeeze.
"Aye, well," he said.
His pupils had begun to shrink. His eyes were sea-deep and fathomless, as though he looked into a great distance.
"Tell me, Sassenach," he said a moment later, "if someone stood a man before you and told you that if you were to cut off your finger, the man would live, and if you did not, he would die, would you do it?"
"I don't know," I said, slightly startled. "If that was the choice, and no doubt about it, and he was a good man, yes, I suppose I would. I wouldn't like it a bit, though," I added practically, and his mouth curved in a smile.
"No," he said.
His expression was growing soft and dreamy.
"Did you know," he said after a moment, "a colonel came to see me whilst you were at work with the wounded?" "Colonel Johnson? Micah Johnson, his name was."
"No. What did he say?" His grip on my bottom was beginning to slacken. I put my own hand over his to hold it in place.
"It was his company in the fight. Part of Morgan's and the rest of the regiment just over the hill in the path of the British. If the charge had gone through, they'd have lost the company, surely," he said. "And God knows what might have become of the rest."
His soft Highland burr was growing broader, his eyes fixed on my skirt.
"So you saved them," I said gently. "How many men are there in a company?"
50, he said. "Though they wouldn't all have been killed, I didn't suppose."
His hand slipped. He caught it and took a fresh grip, chuckling slightly. I could feel his breath through my skirt, warm on my thighs.
"I was thinking it was like the Bible, aye?"
"Yes." I pressed his hand against the curve of my hip, keeping it in place.
"That bit where Abraham is bargaining with the Lord for the cities of the plain. Wilt thou not destroy the city," he quoted, "for the sake of 50 just men?" And then Abraham does him down a bit at a time, from 50 to 40, and then to 30 and 20 and 10.
His eyes were half closed, and his voice peaceful and unconcerned.
"I didn't have time to inquire into the moral state of any of the men in that company. But you'd think there might be 10 just men among them. Good men?"
"I'm sure there are." His hand was heavy, his arm gone nearly limp.
"Or 5. Or even one. One would be enough.
I'm sure there's one.
The apple-faced laddie that helped you with the wounded. He's one.
Yes, he's one. He sighed deeply, his eyes nearly shut.
Tell him I didn't grudge him the finger then, he said.
I held his good hand tightly for a minute. He was breathing slowly and deeply, his mouth gone slack in utter relaxation. I rolled him gently onto his back and laid the hand across his chest.
Bloody man, I whispered. I knew you'd make me cry.
The camp outside lay quiet, in the last moments of slumber before the rising sun should stir the men to movement. I could hear the occasional call of a picket and the murmur of conversation as two foragers passed close by my tent, bound for the woods to hunt. The campfires outside had burned to embers, but I had three lanterns, arranged to cast light without shadow. I laid a thin square of soft pine across my lap as a working surface. Jamie lay face down on the camp bed, head turned toward me so I could keep an eye on his colour. He was solidly asleep. His breath came slow, and he didn't flinch when I pressed the sharp tip of a probe against the back of his hand.
Already.
The hand was swollen, puffy and discoloured, the sword wound a thick black line against the sun-gold skin. I closed my eyes for a moment, holding his wrist, counting his pulse.
One, and two, and three, and four.
I seldom prayed consciously when preparing for surgery, but I did look for something, something I couldn't describe, but always recognized. A certain quietness of soul, the detachment of mind in which I could balance on that knife edge between ruthlessness and compassion. At once engaged in utmost intimacy with the body under my hands, and capable of destroying what I touched in the name of healing.
One, and two, and three, and four.
I realized with a start that my own heartbeat had slowed. The pulse in my fingertip matched that in Jamie's wrist, beat for beat, slow and strong. If I was waiting for a sign, I suppose that would do.
Ready, steady, go.
I thought, and picked up the scalpel. A short horizontal incision over the fourth and fifth knuckles, then down, cutting the skin nearly to the wrist. I undermined the skin carefully with the scissors' tips, then pinned back the loose flap of skin with one of the long steel probes, digging it into the soft wood of the board. I had a small bulb atomizer filled with a solution of distilled water and alcohol. Sterility being impossible, I used this to lay a fine mist over the operating field and wash away the first welling of blood. Not too much. The vasoconstrictor I had given him was working, but the effect wouldn't last long. I gently nudged apart the muscle fibres, those that were still whole, to expose the bone and its overlying tendons gleaming silver among the vivid colours of the body. The sword had cut the tendon nearly through, an inch above the carpal bones. I severed the few remaining fibres, and the hand twitched disconcertingly in reflex. I bit my lip. But it was all right. Aside from the hand, he hadn't moved. He felt different. His flesh had more life than that of a man under ether or pentothal. He was not anaesthetised, but only drugged into stupor. The feel of his flesh was resilient. Not the pliant flaccidity I had been accustomed to in my days at the hospital in my own time. Still, it was a far cry and an immeasurable relief from the live and panicked convulsions that I had felt under my hands in the surgeon's tent. I brushed the cut tendon aside with the forceps. There was the deep branch of the ulnar nerve, a delicate thread of white myelin, with its tiny branches spreading into invisibility deep in the tissues. Good. It was far enough toward the fifth finger that I could work without damage to the main nerve trunk. You never knew. Textbook illustrations were one thing.
But the first thing any surgeon learned was that bodies were unnervingly unique. A stomach would be roughly where you expected it to be, but the nerves and blood vessels that supplied it might be anywhere in the general vicinity, and quite possibly varying in shape and number as well. But now I knew the secrets of this hand. I could see the engineering of it, the structures that gave it form and movement. There was the beautiful strong arch of the third metacarpal, and the delicacy of the web of blood vessels that supplied it. Blood welled, slow and vivid, deep red in the tiny pool of the open field, brilliant scarlet where it stained the chopped bone, a dark and royal blue in the tiny vein that pulsed below the joint, a crusty black at the edge of the original wound, where it had clotted. I had known, without asking myself how, that the fourth metacarpal was shattered. It was. The blade had struck near the proximal end of the bone, splintering its tiny head near the centre of the hand. I would take that too, then. The free chunks of bone would have to be removed in any case to prevent them irritating the adjoining tissues. Removing the metacarpal would let the third and fifth fingers lie close together, in effect narrowing the hand and eliminating the awkward gap that would be left by the missing finger. I pulled hard on the mangled finger to open the articular space between the joints, then used the tip of the scalpel to sever the ligament. The cartilages separated with a tiny but audible pop, and Jamie jerked and groaned, his hand twisting in my grasp. "Hush," I whispered to him, holding tight. "Hush. It's all right. I'm here. It's all right." I could do nothing for the boys dying on the field, but here, for him, I could offer magic and know the spell would hold. He heard me, deep in troubled opium dreams. He frowned and muttered something unintelligible, then sighed deeply and relaxed, his wrist going once more limp under my hand. Somewhere, near at hand, a rooster crowed, and I glanced at the wall of the tent. It was noticeably lighter, and a faint dawn wind drifted through the slit behind me, cool on the back of my neck. Detach the underlying muscle with as little damage as could be managed. Tie off the small digital artery and two other vessels that seemed large enough to bother with. Sever the last few fibres and shreds of skin that held the finger, then lift it free, the dangling metacarpal surprisingly white and naked like a rat's tail. It was a clean, neat job, but I felt a brief sense of sadness as I set the mangled piece of flesh aside. I had a fleeting vision of him holding newly born Jemmy, counting the tiny fingers and toes, delight and wonder on his face. His father had counted his fingers, too. "It's all right," I whispered, as much to myself as to him. "It's all right. It will heal." The rest was quick. Forceps to pluck out the tiny pieces of shattered bone. I debrided the wound as best I could, removing bits of grass and dirt, even a tiny swatch of fabric that had been driven into the flesh. Then, no more than a matter of cleaning the ragged edge of the wound, snipping a small excess of skin, and suturing the incisions. A paste of garlic and white oak leaves mixed with alcohol and spread thickly over the hand, a padding of lint and gauze, and a tight bandage of linen and adhesive plasters to reduce the swelling and encourage the third and fifth fingers to draw closer together. The sun was nearly up. The lantern overhead seemed dim and feeble. My eyes were burning from the close work and the smoke of fires. There were voices outside, the voices of officers moving among the men, rousing them to face the day. And the enemy? I laid Jamie's hand on the cot near his face. He was pale, but not excessively so, and his lips were a light rosy colour, not blue. I dropped the instruments into a bucket of alcohol and water, suddenly too tired to clean them properly. I wrapped the discarded finger in a linen bandage, not quite sure what to do with it, and left it on the table. "Rise and shine, rise and shine,"
came the sergeant's rhythmic cry from outside, punctuated by witty variations and crude responses from reluctant risers. I didn't bother to undress. If there was fighting today,